You're listening to Out of the Blue on 3CR Community Radio, and I'm James Whitmore, coming to you from beautiful Wurundjeri country here in Melbourne. And I acknowledge the custodians of sea country here in Victoria and around Australia. It's our last show of the year, and this week we're exploring Australia's untold queer maritime history. I'll be right back after this.
Get ready for an exciting summer on 3CR's Community Radio. While many of our regular shows take a well-deserved break, we're still here to keep you connected with fantastic radical radio all summer long. Join us for a lineup of unique one-off specials and highlights from the year that you won't want to miss. Curious about what we have in store? Dive into our summer grid at 3cr.org.au/summer specials.
You're listening to Out of the Blue on 3CR Community Radio. Queer people have always found a way to survive, even under violence and oppression. If you head down to the Australian Queer Archives at the Pride Centre in St Kilda, you'll find an absolute treasure trove of stories from throughout Australia's history. And the sea is no exception. From European invasion to today, from the Navy to passenger ships, Australia's maritime history is full of queer stories. Dr. Graham Willett has been researching Australia's queer history since 1979. He's a former president and current volunteer coordinator of the Australian Queer Archives, and his new project is uncovering Australia's queer maritime history. I spoke to Graham about what these stories reveal to us about the place of queer people in Australian society.
Hi, Graham. Thanks for joining us on Out of the Blue. To start with, I just want to talk about the mermaid in the room, which is that seafaring does have a bit of a queer reputation hanging over it. Where does that come from?
As far as we can tell, it's been there for a really long time in sort of the British world and Europe. Sailors' uniforms have always had a kind of an appeal, a kind of fetishistic appeal to homosexual men, camp men, gay men. I think it's still there. You don't see as many sailors as you used to, but I think given the opportunity, people would still sort of lust after them if they passed down the street.
What fascinates you about Australia's queer maritime history?
I got interested in this after Joe Stanley and a colleague did a book called Hello Sailor, which was about British maritime queer history. It must be 20 years now since it was published, but it's a terrific book. And they did a lot of research, the archives, records of various kinds, oral histories. And I've recently found myself thinking about it and whether you could do the same thing in Australia. And it became fairly clear fairly quickly that you could. There's enough material out there, both from the 19th and the 20th centuries, to tell some of these stories. And more important than telling stories, it's about using what we'd learned to understand the time and the place in which these things are positioned.
So when we say maritime history, what exactly are we talking about?
Yeah, so it's very broadly defined. It's kind of anybody who works at sea. So the Navy is the obvious thing during wartime and outside wartime. But, you know, even in the Navy, there are fighters and there are crew who kind of provide stuff, support. There's a commercial or civilian Navy, the Merchant Marine. More recently, like in the last 30, 40 years, a bit longer, there's been passenger ships, you know, cruise ships, passenger ships in particular for the migrants. I mean, Australia has always been a maritime nation. It's much more a maritime nation than it is a desert nation, actually, because most people live on the coast. And so there are a range of different kinds of people who work on the ships or nearby. I think the ports also count. Sailors come into Melbourne, and that's an important part of Melbourne's history, Sydney's history. And there are, in fact, we don't know much about this yet, but there are these big inland ports. Australia's badly served by its rivers. But places like Echuca on the Murray, were big port towns because they were part of getting the stuff from the farms and the farms especially and onto the seas. So it's a very rich history, it's a very diverse history in terms of the people, but also the places that count.
You mentioned that you're looking at the 19th and 20th centuries. Presumably Australia does have a queer maritime history that predates that. I mean, you can imagine maybe Mackesan queer seafarers and, you know, probably Indigenous queer seafarers. So just why focus on the 19th and 20th centuries? Is it just that that's the information that's available in the archives?
Yeah, we still know very little about First Nations queer history, and particularly the prehistory before the colonists and colonisers turn up. The oldest story that we do have comes from 1727, so long before Captain Cook turns up on the East Coast. The Dutch had discovered the West Coast on their way to what they called the Spice Islands. And they, at one point, a ship, 1727, a ship called the Dif Zeevik, runs aground. And while they're there kind of gathering up the bits of the ship to produce, to fix it, two young men are caught having sex. This, of course, is not only, was it? Yes, it is still against Dutch law, but it's much more dangerous than that. They see it as a kind of unlikely to evoke God's wrath. So they have to be convicted by, obviously, a court's martial, a ship's captain. They also then get sentenced and they're stranded ashore. We say islands, but they're two kind of rocky outcrops, really, two separate islands, where they're left to die of hunger, thirst and exposure. It's a particularly horrifying case. I mean, God knows queer history has a lot of horrifying cases, but this is a really awful one. And it kind of sets the level for the worst outcomes.
Yes, that is a really, you know, quite shocking case. Can you then, and you've also found some interesting things about some very famous and well-known people in Australia. Can you talk a bit about Matthew Flinders and George Bass?
Good old Matthew Flinders. So about 20 years ago or something, a letter that Flinders had written to George Bass turned up. And the New South Wales State were terribly excited. They paid, I imagine, a lot of money for it. And most of it is full of kind of navigation talk because that's what they did. They navigated, they circumnavigated Australia. They discovered all kinds of stuff that the Europeans didn't know about. But in the course of this letter, Flinders writes to George Bass saying that if he, Flinders, was sitting below deck trying to read and he heard George Bass on deck walking around, he would get really distracted. He couldn't concentrate on what he was doing and he would go up on board, up onto the deck. And Bass was often very dismissive of him and took great offence at this. He was hurt more than offended. And he writes quite movingly, really, about how bad he feels. Now, the State Library were very keen when they first got this thing to emphasise that, you know, people wrote in very flowery language in those days. But when he describes what he's doing as opposed to the kind of language he's using, you know, I'm getting distracted, I can't concentrate, you're really horrible to me. If it was a Jane Austen novel, we would know exactly what was going on between these two characters. And I think we have a right to, we use that to interrogate what intimacy meant between men. There's no reason to think they had sex. There's no reason to think they didn't. But you know, the way people, men and women related to each other then is a much more complicated story than we have usually told it as. And that's one of the ways we can use it to think about these kinds of issues.
And I think it kind of touches on a more general idea around queer history. Is that how do you figure out if people are queer? They're not always, you know, declaring themselves.
Yeah. I have a kind of running definition I've been working on for a few years now. It's basically about intimacy, non-conforming intimacies. So if a man and a woman are in love or write flowery letters to each other, that's one thing. If two men do, it depends what's in the letter. So in the case of the Flinders-Bass correspondence. It's about not conforming. It's not about genitals because we almost never know, except in court cases much later. And it's all not about identities because, as far as we tell, very few people had identities as what we would call homosexual or lesbian or whatever. Some did. We certainly know some, do, but really it's about those kind of non-conforming intimacies that I think we get to claim. I mean, I used to just say that, you know, we give them the benefit of the doubt and assume they were, and we gather them into the story basket. But I think we can do better than that. We can try harder and do better with our who's in and who's out.
Can you tell us a bit about, this is a really fascinating story, Edward de Lacy Evans, who arrived in Australia in 1856 as Ellen Tremay, but then lived, worked, married three times as a man. How do they relate to Australia's maritime history?
So it's the coming to Australia. I mean, everybody came by ship until really the 1950s and 60s, honestly. The migrants, this was the height of the gold rush, so... and also a period when the shortage of women was starting to be addressed by importing women to be domestics and then to get married and start to stabilise the Australian demographic. So Ellen Tremay comes to Australia on a ship in 1856, almost immediately, as soon as, not the day after, but very quickly after arriving, adopts a male persona. And this rather fancy name of Edward de Lacy Evans, we don't know why, we don't know where they get it from. And then, as I say, lives as a man, works as a man, has all the kind of, if you like, advantages of being a man in a very sexist society. But does, as I say, gets married three times. The first time is to a woman called Mary Delahunty, who was on board with Ellen Tremay. So clearly Delahunty knew who Edward de Lacy Evans was. And that also then opens up all sorts of questions. That marriage didn't last. The second marriage didn't last. The third marriage seemed to have been more successful until his wife got pregnant. Now, this is either a miracle of some kind, or more likely what the wife claimed was that she'd been having an affair with her brother-in-law. So not as miraculous as we might hope. At about that time, de Lacy Evans has a sort of nervous collapse in the street and is taken to Bendigo or Ballarat Hospital. Very recalcitrant patient, will not cooperate and so on. So they send him to the Kew Asylum in Melbourne, where he's kind of forcibly processed, including taking his clothes off in order to bathe him and clean him up. That's when they discover that he's got the body of a woman. Somebody leaks that to the press and it goes sort of what we would say viral very, very quickly. Not clear that, clearly getting married, impersonating a man in order to get married to women is a crime, but they're never charged with a crime. They just kind of live with the kind of infamy of who they were. It's a very important case. It gets a lot of attention. And it's something that people talk about in the press for decades afterwards, every time there's any kind of, kind of queer sex scandal, somebody will remember the case of Edward de Lacy Evans.
That's Dr. Graham Willip talking about Australia's queer maritime history. And we'll hear more from Graham after this. You're listening to Out of the Blue on 3CR Community Radio.
Hopefully we can protect everything that's worth protecting on country and keep all warmongers out.
Well, I won't back down.
Gugatha elder Anisu Hasseldine is fighting to protect her country from Southern Launch's rocket testing range. Southern Launch's collaborations with international weapons companies such as Thales, as well as the Australian Defence Force, are threatening sacred sites, endangered animals and unique ecosystems. Join West Mallee Protection, letter writing calling on key decision makers to get Southern Launch off Gugatha country. For more information, visit West Mallee Protection on Instagram. West Mallee Protection is a 3CR supporter. And I won't
back down. You're listening to Out of the Blue on 3CR Community Radio. I'm talking to Dr. Graham Willip about uncovering Australia's queer maritime history and some of the fascinating stories of queer people at sea.
Can you talk a bit about where you find these people in the archives? Because it's kind of like detective work, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. When I first started, I wasn't sure how much there would be. There's, in fact, an enormous amount. So there's these big stories, Edward de Lacy Evans, the boys on the Zivik and so on, which have been researched and reported on. But Australia historians were inclined to say Australia was born capitalist, never really had feudalism and slavery and so on, leaving all that aside for the moment. But it's also born bureaucratic. You know, the governing officials, Sydney is a very contained place for a very long time. They keep a close eye on the population. When they set up a kind of place of secondary detention in Tasmania, Port Arthur and in Launceston, they're keeping close eye on what's going on. And we have amazing records about men loving men, women loving women. We probably know more about how ordinary working class people lived at that time in Australia than we do anywhere else in the world, because the authorities are keeping an eye on them, reporting on them, worrying about them. The medical officers were absolutely fascinated with the women in what was called the female factory, the female workplace prison, and reported in great detail on their bodies and their behaviours and so on. So that gives us a lot of detail. Then, of course, you have court records. The police aren't always very interested in sodomy, but when they are, they have to explain themselves to the courts. People who are being charged get to speak. Judges get to respond by saying why they're punishing them or not. So court records are really important. There's a lot of bureaucratic material. There's also, of course, the work that academics are doing. I mean, beginning in about the 1980s or 90s, it's not hard to get funding for academic work, you know, major research projects and that, on queer history, queer subjects. A lot of that is influenced by HIV/AIDS, which, of course, is massively funded, both in terms of treatment, but also in terms of research to understand what's going on and how we can change people's behaviour. So there's a lot of material out there. And part of the problem is sort of ploughing through it all and sort of help getting bits and pieces out of it.
So we talked a bit about like the 19th century in particular, but zooming forward into the 20th century, you've looked at a really fascinating novel from, I think, the 1960s called Winger's Landfall. Can you just talk a bit about that and what and how that shows how queer lives have changed?
Yeah, I was put onto it by Joe Stanley, who did that early book. The first thing I had to find out what a winger was. I assumed it was the name of the character. It's not. A winger is a steward on a passenger ship. And the story is, officially the story is that the man boards this ship as a winger, as a steward in Sydney. And he's trying to find out how his brother got murdered on the previous journey of the ship. So it's a bit of a kind of detective story. But actually, it's really not a very interesting detective story, but it's absolutely fascinating insight into queer life on board this ship, written by somebody who clearly knew what he was talking about. He wrote a couple of novels around queer life, the sea, the army, the Navy in World War II. And what you get there is just this amazing insight into how people lived. You know, the kind of butch femme roles that are often being played out, the parties that they're having, and not just the kind of crossing the equator parties, which I don't know if people still know about them, but they're a huge deal. But, you know, private parties that the crew would have for themselves, the sexual relationships that they developed, the slang that they use, the way they refer to each other, the camp names and so on. It's an extraordinary thing. I mean, it's not a great novel by any means, but it's an invaluable source, as long as you use it a bit carefully, I guess. But, you know, guy knows what he's talking about and he's telling us what he's telling. On page 5, we get the first use of the word queer. It's used to describe a fat queer who the guy coming aboard sort of takes exception to. He's quite interesting himself because he doesn't come out very early on. I mean, it's not even clear he knows that he's, well, at the time people have said homosexual camp. But it emerges over the course of the novel that he kind of comes to terms with his sexuality. So it's a great insight into, and, you know, there's class issues and age issues and all those kind of things that really gives us an insight. One of the things Joe Stanley says is that actually life aboard for queer people is just a version of life ashore. Like, it's the same subculture. And once she pointed this out, I realized actually that's true. It's very much the case that there's nothing unique about sea life. They don't develop new kinds of identities or new kinds of behaviours. They just operate in a kind of more contained environment. And they're all there all the time, every day for the whole trip, you know, so they have time to develop 24 hours a day the kind of relationships that they want to have or the experiences they want to have.
You mentioned that studying this queer history can tell us more things about society generally. So what are some of the insights that are coming from this research?
Yeah, I mean, in the 19th century, what's obvious is the lack of any kind of community or subculture. I mean, sometimes there are signs of it, but, you know, Edward de Lacy Evans doesn't seem to mingle with other queer people. Most of the people, men being arrested, because it wasn't against the law for women to have sex with each other, but most of the men there seem to kind of find each other to have sex, but not really in the 19th century as part of a kind of expressing their innermost self in the way that we take for granted now. By the 20th century, it's really about how minorities are treated, and more it becomes the case that beginning really in the 1950s and 60s, the idea that the homosexual is a particular kind of person, but also they're a kind of victim of themselves. They're not. There is a lot of hatred, and there are laws that persecute and prosecute homosexuals, but there's an emergence of a subculture that people find other people. They go to the same places. There are five or six pubs in Melbourne, for example, including one that's particularly, I guess, notorious, people would have said at the time, where sailors would go. The Hotel Australia, for example, which beginning certainly immediately after World War II, probably before, but after World War II, sailors will go there when they're ashore because they can be confident that they'll get picked up, that somebody will buy them drinks, somebody will buy the feed, and all they have to do then is go home and have sex with this person. Which, you know, if you don't want to do it, you don't do it. But that was certainly part of what was going on. That was downstairs at the Hotel Australia. Upstairs was much more posh. People came after work in their suits. Downstairs, it was known as the Snake Pit, which gives you a sense of what the atmosphere was like. So it's a place, the emergence of known places where you could expect to pick up or be picked up, parks and beats and so on. Whatever. Beats map at the archives, a big, great big wall, one of the big Melways wall maps, which has about 20 or 30 beats marked in it by somebody who clearly had done a lot of research and knew a lot about it, including the kind of funny names that they had. You know, the Spanish Mission, which was down on St Kilda Beach, near St Kilda Beach, Stiffies at the Melbourne General Cemetery. So these kind of places become known and they become focuses of attention. People meet there, but they do so as much for social life as for the sex. And that's sort of relates back to the maritime stuff. Some years ago now, Noah Reisman, Charlene Robinson, I helped a little bit, did a great big research project, Oral Histories for People in the Military. Who remembered, queer people in the military who remembered the past. And some of their stories are pretty amazing. And so we know a lot from that, people remembering as far back as the memory goes, which is really kind of World War II, which gives us a big insight, again, amongst other things, to the Navy and its role in queer life.
Why is it important to uncover these stories and share them?
Oh, they ask me this. My response is I don't do it because it's important. I do it because I love it. But I think it is important because the way we live now, we live as queer people, any of the kind of alphabet letters, but the kind of broader community. And that sense that we have a history, for me particularly, it's about how we got from there to here, how, you know, in 1969 it was against the law for men to have sex with each other. You would be expected to be discriminated against. A responsible employer would discriminate against anyone in their workforce they found was homosexual. Nobody wanted to appeal to the gay market or anything like that. So somehow we got from that to this. And that process is a historical process. And I think, amongst other things, it involves understanding all kinds of aspects of Australian society, including, as I say, the maritime stuff, which after all brings people from overseas to Australia. I don't think it's an accident that the gay or camp subculture in Australia in the 40s, 50s is exactly the same as the one in Britain, because that's where it comes from. And mostly that, not just from sailors, not just from maritime workers. There's a very nice story somebody told us at the archives. He used to work in immigration. And as they were unloading a shipload of migrants at one point, somebody came up to him and said, that guy over there, he's a homosexual. You don't want him in your country. I had no idea what to do about this. So I went away and checked the laws. There was no law against migrating to Australia as a homosexual, which is not true in Britain, not true in Canada and the US. So they kind of dithered a bit, but well, there's nothing we could do about it. We'll just let him in. So somewhere out there, is it, you know, somebody living a happy homosexual life, or for a long time was, because they were, you know, let in. And that's, again, an indication. It's always a rule, if we know about one, there are others that we don't know about, and there may well be lots and lots of others. And sometimes we get that from oral histories, people who migrated here, either because they were gay or discovered they were gay when they got here.
Graham, thank you so much for joining us on Out of the Blue.
Glad to do it.
That was Dr. Graham Willett, who is researching Australia's queer maritime history and uncovering some of the wonderful and fascinating stories of queer people at sea. You can find today's episode and all our previous episodes on 3cr.org.au/radioblue. You can also follow our Facebook page for updates. This is our last show for the year, and we'll be taking a break until January 25. Maybe you can find some time over the summer to get down to the water and explore some of Melbourne's amazing marine life. And it's also my last show for Out of the Blue. I've been presenting since 2020, and I've loved bringing you stories about the amazing creatures that call the sea home, and all the people who are working so hard to protect them, whether they're researchers, activists, writers, or artists. Out of the Blue will be back next year with all our great presenters and new stories to inspire and inform you. Thank you for listening.